Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Welcome, Morris to Morris Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana Elbay. And we have a very, very good lineup of information for you today. And what I would like for you to do at this point is go ahead and get you a piece of paper and pencil and so you can take notes. And also, you're going to have to listen to this information over and over and over again to you clearly understand it. It will be put into Hawker's library in its entirety and all of its video format and audio format, so you have access to it in the near future. let me start out by saying that what I would like for you to do, for those of you who are listening to this for the first time, or if you haven't gotten a hold of my information, I offer two free articles. The 14th Amendment Exposed, as well as The Commerce Game and How to Play. Now, this information is vital. It is vital for every person inside the United States of African descent and Moorish descent to contact me in regards to getting this information. The way you get it is simply by contacting me at tahaka99@yahoo.com. That's tahaka99@yahoo.com, and I'll rush that information to you. The 14th Amendment Exposed, as well as The Commerce Game, and that gives you the basic foundation of what is taking place inside the United States and how it is affecting you at the very foundation. We need to get that clearly understood. This is why I keep drilling this information over and over and over. It is inside Tahaka's library, my archive, which is the most comprehensive library inside the United States for people of African descent, Moorish descent only. This is yours. This is not like going downtown in your city into a library where there's tons of worthless information that you got to sift through, and after you get it all in your head, the only thing that you have is information, and you cannot achieve anything. What we're doing is we're providing you with the solution. You got a problem with child support? We have a solution. You got a problem with the police officers, and driver's license, and taxes, and mortgages, and somebody's committing fraud against you? Somebody trying to take your children away? Somebody trying to lock you up? Whatever it is, go ahead and contact me at area code 904-303-9061. Now, I am not an attorney, and I'll do the best I can, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to direct you to the solution. See, when you go to a hospital and you get inside that hospital and you got an ailment, let's say you got cancer, you got a tumor, you got a bursitis, whatever it is. It doesn't matter what it is. What they're going to do is offer you treatment, because if they offer you the solution, they offer you the cure, and you are cured, you simply won't come back anymore. So that means there is no repeat business. And the doctors and nurses cannot live in big, fabulous homes and go on all these vacations and all that. So what we got to do is we got to offer you treatment. We cannot cure you. We're going to give you something from the pharmaceutical industry that is not natural, that does not appear in the ancient African records that you call your Bible for your cure. The natural herbs and for the healings of the nations is omitted. We're not going to give you that because if you are cured, if we're depending on 1,000 people to come in here and spend $1,000 apiece in the hospital, and we give 1,000 people a cure, and all 1,000 people are cured, then we don't have no more people. So how are we going to pay for that $200,000-$400,000 home we're living in? No, we cannot offer you a cure. What we're going to offer you is treatment. We're going to string you along, and we're going to sap you for all of the financial resources that you have until you die. And when we come to your loved ones and tell them that we did everything we could to try to save them, the first thing your loved ones should ask is, could you please give me a listing of the natural cures that's indigenous to the body that you gave them? If they don't have that, then I suggest you call me, because we'll go ahead on and accept their offer. Enter a counteroffer that carries liability and tell them how much we're going to sue them for. But in the first place, we ain't going up in there. We're going to contact me in regards to Tahaka's library, because within that library is a cure. Also, the remedy and the solution for what problems you got. Now, tonight, we're going to deal with our several things. We're going to deal with your taxes. We want to know what the president got to say about the Moors, as well as Islam. We want to know about your position as a free man on the land. We want to deal with that. How you use your signature to set off debt. We're going to let that come on. That information is already in the library. I'm just bringing a few excerpts out of there tonight so you can, for those of you who haven't gotten to it that already have the library, we can let you know what you got tonight. And not only that, is that information there, there is a ton of other information there in that regard is there as well. We're going to deal with this, the gun laws. We need to deal with that. We're going to bring that out. We're going to hear what the Moors have to say in regards to taxes. We're going to bring that out. We're going to deal with whether or not the government of the United States is corrupt. Now, we cannot call the government corrupt. We don't want to accuse anybody of doing anything wrong until we at least look at all the cards. Now, I'm not big on people outside of my species, never have been. But I can never be accused of being a racist because I have to consider that as an insult. And the reason being is the way I look at this thing is this. If my DNA go all the way back to the beginning of time, and it carries what we're calling melanin, which is no such thing as some term somebody else coined it, high concentrations of carbon. And all people on the earth descended from me, and I built the greatest civilization the world could ever comprehend, then how can I be accused of envying somebody who just learned how to read and write yesterday? That's an insult. Hey, don't insult me. If my name was Jack Johnson and I got up in the ring and proved beyond any shadow of a doubt who was the real man in America until I got tired and I decided to stop, then why should I be accused of hating anybody, being envious of anybody that don't look like me? No, that's an insult. Now, although we're going to have the lines open for questions and comments, for those of you who are on your social sites, I got to give you this right now. Now, we ran an experiment this week, And what I did is I took five people that I knew personally, and I went into the main search engine, found them, and befriended them through Facebook. But today, as usual, I got a message from Facebook that says, you're banned for 30 days from befriending people that you don't know. So this thing seems to be automatic. Now, last week, we put a plug on, last show I did, I put a plug on that told you that the Facebook is owned, operated, and controlled by the Central Intelligence Agency. And so I have no choice but to go over straight right now to deal with what the prophet says. If the prophet says, if I can only get the Moors to think, if I can only get you to think. Now, I'm going to leave that alone. Okay? I'm going to leave that alone. And the first thing that we are going to deal with now is we're going to set the tone for some things. And for those of you who are on the social sites, I've been banned for 30 days, so what I need you to do is send me your friend request, because I'm going to eventually leave there, and I won't be there anymore. But I need you to think about what we're trying to tell you. You know, don't be like it was, the story goes in Noah's day, and Noah told the people it was going to rain. They didn't listen to Noah. Then it started raining. Next thing you know, they were knocking on the boat. Open up the door. Can we come in? And Noah said, well, no, I can't let you in because the Lord has sealed the door from the inside. I can't let you in. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's raining, and I'm trying to tell you something. My passion is my people, the one that looks like me. My people come first. Everybody else comes second. They would never let me stand before the United States as the President of the United States, because I would have no choice but to call for all people in America to bow your heads and pray to the God to look like me. Probably be shot dead, but I don't have no choice. I can't go no other way. Anyway, we're going to move right along. Get ready and hold your hat, because we're going to ride and we're going to do some things. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to start with the President of the United States.
I also know civilization's debt to Islam. It was Islam at places like Uluzad that carried the light of learning through so many centuries, paving the way for Europe's Renaissance and enlightenment. It was innovation in Muslim communities. It was innovation in Muslim communities that developed the order of algebra, our magnetic compass and tools of navigation, our mastery of pens and printing, our understanding of how disease spreads and how it can be healed. Islamic culture has given us majestic arches and soaring spires, timeless poetry and cherished music, endless poetry and places of peaceful contemplation. And throughout history, Islam has demonstrated through words and deeds the possibilities of religious tolerance and racial equality. I also know that Islam has always been a part of America's story. The first nation to recognize my country was Morocco. In signing the Treaty of Tripoli in 1796, our second president, John Adams, wrote, "The United States has in itself no character of enmity against the laws, religion, or tranquility of Muslims." And since our founding, American Muslims have enriched the United States. They have fought in our wars, they have served in our government, they have stood for civil rights, they have started businesses, they have taught at our universities, they've excelled in our sports arenas, they've won Nobel Prizes, built our tallest building, and lit the Olympic torch. And when the first Muslim American was recently elected to Congress, he took the oath to defend our Constitution using the same Holy Quran that one of our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, kept in his personal library. So I have known Islam on three continents before coming to the region where it was first revealed. That experience guides my conviction that partnership between America and Islam must be based on what Islam is, not what it isn't. And I consider it part of my responsibility as President of the United States to fight against negative stereotypes of Islam wherever they appear. But that same principle must apply to Muslim perceptions of America. Just as Muslims do not fit a crude stereotype, America is not the crude stereotype of a self-interested empire. The United States has been one of the greatest sources of progress that the world has ever known.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we just want to bring that little bit of information out there, and I commend the President of the United States for putting that out there. And we're going to go directly into the next segment, and this next segment is something apart from what is very important for you to understand is what the President of the United States has just said, but equally as important. As important is the next segment that we're going to run for you so that you can get a clear understanding of the foundation. You cannot build a house without a foundation. It doesn't matter how hard you try. I know because I've been in the construction building business. We build caps and columns for bridges. We laid pipe across the nation, a 36-inch concrete pipe. We did finishing work, roofing, framing, you name it. And one thing was always important. What does the foundation look like?
Think of an aspect of your life that dictates the limits of your freedom. Government and law enforcement, insurance and pharmaceutical companies, taxes, building permits, driver's licenses, and more. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of stipulations, regulations, and boundaries on our freedom. And out of the ones that were just mentioned, how many have you researched to find out whether they apply to you or not? Let's look at the forms of law that we currently acquiesce to. A common misconception among people is that any rule or regulation that governs them falls under one category, law. But there are many other forms of law that people abide by without realizing that they simply do not apply to them. Another misconception is that a nation's constitution gives us our rights. A constitution does nothing more than list the rights that we already have. We are born with inalienable rights, endowed to us by our Creator. They are not given to us, and they cannot be given away. The most a person can do with a right is choose whether to exercise it or not. Maritime admiralty law is what's known as the law of the water. It is superseded by civil law and only applies to those who willingly contract themselves into it. The definition of admiralty law is a body of private international law governing the relationships between private entities which operate vessels on the oceans. Let's look at how and why a form of law that is fashioned to govern corporations, businesses, and vessels has imposed its rule over natural human beings. This is all done through a form of word magic. A simple perversion of language has made it possible to convince people around the world that these alternative laws apply to them. One of the predominant beliefs in modern culture is that licenses, permits, registrations, and other forms of documentation are required to operate motor vehicles, use public roads, build structures and establishments, engage in free enterprise, and much more. Sadly, these beliefs are based on little to no investigation whatsoever and are false. This belief structure is perpetuated by maritime admiralty law. This form of law was originally created to govern ships docking in foreign nations for the import or export of products and resources. It deals with banking and merchant affairs, not civil affairs. When a product is taken off of a ship and brought into a foreign land, that nation takes custody of the resource and accounts for it with a certificate. That certificate marks the birth date of that product in the custody of the respective nation. Think of why it is supposedly required to have a certificate of live birth in the first place. The Barron's Dictionary of Banking Terms defines a certificate as a paper establishing an ownership claim. So right there, we notice that everyone with a birth certificate is defined as being owned. People are used as collateral with other nations because the U.S. is bankrupt. The United States declared bankruptcy on March 9th of 1933. At this point, the U.S. began taking out loans from a private, non-government affiliated corporation called the Federal Reserve. With no money to pay back the loans, the United States began using the citizens as collateral. All birth and marriage certificates are literally warehouse receipts. Just look at the similarities of warehouse receipts and birth certificates. Both document the date of issue, a serial number, registration number or receipt number, a description of the product, and an authorized informant to notify the appropriate government agency. With all of this information being readily available, the majority of people are unaware of their involvement with maritime admiralty law. This is possible through the manipulation of language. This admiralty law changed the meaning of the word person from a natural living person to a corporation. Driver's licenses, vehicle registrations, auto insurance forms, building permits, gun permits, work permits, tax filing documents, birth and death certificates, traffic citations, and many other forms of documentation that were once believed to be absolutely necessary only apply to persons or corporations. Upon signing such a legal document, you are indirectly waiving your rights under the Constitution and lowering your status to that of a corporation that is created with the same exact name as you. The only way to reconcile your true name from the name of the corporation is to take notice that the corporation has its name in all capital letters. This is known as Capitis Diminutia Maxima. You may take notice that your driver's license, birth certificate, social security card, insurance cards, and more use all capital letters to legally represent the corporation with your name, not you. The corporation is known as an artificial person, whereas you, the human being, are known as a natural person. This deception goes even deeper when it comes to the courts that we attend. When showing up to court, you will notice that there are seats for witnesses behind a wooden fence or barrier. The defendant must cross through the entrance to the other side of the barrier where the plaintiff and judge sit. This act symbolizes the boarding of a ship. At this time, business can be conducted in maritime admiralty law. The judge, acting as captain or banker, is responsible for settling the balance between the two sides. This is why there is always a monetary value involved in any court case. The captain is simply dealing with banking and merchant disputes. Once the balance is paid, the case is closed. To turn the court case away from admiralty law where your rights are not protected, you must avoid agreeing to represent the artificial person. This is done by stating that you are the natural person. You don't have a first or last name because those imply corporate title. In a court case, you may state that the court takes judicial notice of your honor's oath of office. Every judge must take an oath of office to practice law, yet you must make it clear to the court and the jury that the judge is acting as judge and not banker. Remember that you are a natural human being of the earth. You are not governed by anything but your own consciousness. Laws are created within a society. The society that created the laws we see being enforced today is called the Law Society. Yet the most beautiful part of this entire deception is the fact that we are not part of the law society, so their laws do not apply to us.
Judges, lawyers, and law enforcement officers, they're all part of a society. Within that society, they've created their own language that's deceptively similar to English. They have these little things called statutes, acts, and regulations that seem like laws, but they really only apply to those within their society. So that basically means all the traffic violations, minimum age requirements, and everything except for damage to another person or their property doesn't really apply to the natural person.
Laws only apply to those within the law society. The game being played is an illusion. You can simply choose to open your eyes and reclaim the freedom that you were born with, bound by nothing but the limits of your imagination. These are just a few examples of assuring that your rights are being protected. By far, the most important line of defense against this deception is to be aware of the perversion of language, and be absolutely aware of how you form your beliefs and concepts. In all forms of the perversion of language, there is a mirror reflection of this in the microcosm of the psyche.
And the problem I see with humanity today is we don't truly know ourselves anymore. We have the 9-to-5 job, we have the house, the children, the bills, the television, the hobbies, and the errands that we run every single day, and we eventually begin to believe that this is who we are. You know, but who are we beneath the job title, beneath the status of mother or father, theist or atheist, Republican or Democrat, black or white, man or woman? Who are we? Who are we deep down inside? We don't know, because every time we hear an answer that we don't want to accept about ourselves, we deny it. We'll pass it off and project it onto somebody else and judge them for it. This is repression. And we see what repression is do to us on an individual level, but what about on a collective level of humanity? What happens when the whole world refuses to see what they truly are on the inside?
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I want to say that if we can understand that, I'm going to just make this here as plain as I possibly can. I've said it over and over and over and over and over to you again, but I talked to my brothers and sisters from all over the United States, and they called me, and they described things to me as if I have said it to them. The only thing that can be dealt with in maritime admiralty law is the fiction. And so therefore, if you remember when you were in third grade, your English teacher taught you the difference between a proper noun and an improper noun. A proper noun is in upper and lowercase letters. An improper noun is in all capital letters. If it's in all capital letters, regardless of what it is, and if it relates to a noun, that simply means that that refers to anything other than a living, breathing being. Okay, when you go in the kitchen to get something to eat, you put it in your body, you're a living, breathing being. You lay down and you go to sleep, you're a living, breathing being. You get in your car to take a drive, you're a living, breathing being. You get sick, you take some medicine, now we're dealing with a living, breathing being. But now, how is it that when you are pulled over by a policeman and he asks for documents that belong to the state, all of a sudden you switch gears? You get a document in all capital letters, you're going, whoa. The mortgage company said, well, We're going to evict you. Evict who? You talking about this person right here in all capital letters? Okay. We ain't hard with you. We're going to get with that. So if you're going to be true most of the time, why don't you go ahead and be true to yourself all the time? If you got anything in your house, your driver's license, Social Security card, all your bills come through, take a look at it, see if it's all capital up. Now, Moore's, once again, I'm going to need you to think. Think, Moore's.
It's Fontes. Who am I speaking with?
Fontes. Yes, this is Burry at Sam's Club.
Yes, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I had some information on your tax exempt on what we needed to do and what we have on for to be tax exempt here at Sam's Club. First of all, the items that you have to purchase tax exempt would be for resale, would be one category, and then the next one would be like a nonprofit organization, and the other one would be a state or government entity.
Now,
Yes.
Again.
Do you qualify for any of those?
Whenever you're the corporation in which the corporate fiction in which you're employed by has first an obligation to me as I am a national. Now, you can check the laws, the federal laws. That means that if they don't have any documentation on there for nationals, something's not right. Because I'm not...
For sales tax, it has to be taken up with the state. It's not a federal.
But that's a corporate state. I am not a ward of the state, and I am not operating with the benefits as a corporation. I'm a natural person. I say again, my name is not spelled with all capital letters in a cognomen. I am not, and your company didn't use full disclosure when they took the nomen and the cognomen and turned them into a corporate fiction, and that's called fraud. And I'm trying to work with you. I don't want any trouble like that. I just want you to uphold your obligations to me. And I'm objecting to the fact that when you transfer a tax to an individual who objects to it, that's called extortion. That's a no-no. That's reducing a person's labors to peonage. You can't do that. I have a nationality. Now, with the nationality, my rights are secured, inalienable, unalienable by the Constitution. And then, let me say this really fast. At the front desk,
let me write this down and what your qualifications would be. It's a nationality. What?
I am a national. I am Aboriginal and indigenous to this landmass. I'm a Moor.
So in the state of Idaho, that is supposed to
again,
be...
Again, you're saying this... I am a member of the Republic, the organic state of Idaho, not a corporate state.
So you're living here in Idaho, correct?
I live in the organic state of Idaho. I am not a corporate fiction. I am not operating as a corporation. And you can't force that upon me and transfer your taxes to me. Trust me, I deal with this all the time. That's a serious no-no.
Well, you might need to take that up with the state of Idaho.
Again, no, it's your company that I'm dealing with. And so
correct, but we deal with the state of Idaho.
And that's not, I don't have any contracts. I don't have any contracts with the state of Idaho. You have contracts with the state of Idaho, not me. With the corporate state.
The only time we don't collect sales tax for the state of Idaho is if it's for resale.
I'll explain this to you.
Or if it's a nonprofit organization, or if it's a government.
The paperwork I gave you, is more than enough that you put that in your documentation to write off, to say that you offered it to me, an offer. I did not, I considered the offer. I did not accept it because I'm not waiving any of my rights. And so again, I'm letting you know right now, under Title 18, that's called fraud, extortion, and racketeering. And I'm trying to work with you because you can't force that on me. And all they're going to see is that you're trying to force that obligation on me. And you can't do that, man. Again, I'm in the organic landmass of Idaho. I am not a corporate fiction, and I'm not operating as a corporation. I have a nationality. And I also will make sure I forward this information to the international criminal courts, because that's not how it works.
Okay.
Now, I'm trying to tell you how to deal with it. If I went to you and I wanted a job with your corporation, I don't even have to take out Social Security. You're not obligated to do so. And all I have to do is you would offer it to me, and I would give you a written letter of consent showing you that you offered it to me. That's all you have to do is offer it to me. That's the only obligation you have. No different than when my child was born. I had a baby that was just my child was born not too long ago. He is not a part. He's not a ward of the state. The people who birthed him offered a particular document to me. I did not accept it. I wrote them a piece of paper saying they offered it to me, and they were waived. Instead of being fined by the corporation that they have a contract with, I don't have a contract with them. But when you're taking my personalities as a servant is worthy of his hire, and I went and bought something with that's my personal property, and you're taxing my personalities. You don't have a delegation of authority order from Congress to lay and collect taxes from anyone. And that's a corporate fiction in which you're laying, that you're collecting taxes for, because you have a contract with them, because they're transferring debts to what are called through enfranchisement. My name is not a European cognomen. My name is Morris. And so you can't, it's unalienable. You can't transfer a bond to it. You can't put liens against it, because I'm not using an enfranchised name. I'm trying to tell you how it works.
Well, I'm trying to tell you what our guidelines are here.
All right, here's what, my friend, here's what. Know this. It's a corporate fiction in which I'm dealing with. And so I always can record my phone calls. And so I'm dealing with you a corporate fiction, meaning you're trying to pull me into your jurisdiction, and I'm telling you I object to it. So you can tell I'll tell you this. By this afternoon, or before this afternoon, as soon as I'm off the phone with you, this phone call will be all over the Internet, and it'll also be, the link will be forwarded to the International Criminal Courts. And then you talk to me about what you're saying, because that's called a forced obligation, that taxes were forced on me. Forced obligation is denoted as peonage. Peonage is definitely abolished. Now, I know the law very well.
All I know is the guidelines that I have to go by.
All right, well,
here.
I appreciate, you know what?
You're going to be taken up by the state of Idaho.
Well, no, you have to take that up.
Office.
Well, here's what, my friend. Again, I'm getting ready to post this all over the Internet and all over the web. So they'll know, and that way I have proof. I have proof that I was being extorted. I have proof of peonage, of trying to reduce me to a state of peonage. Forced obligation denotes slavery, my friend. And you don't have any.
Did you have the right to put anything you want on the Internet?
Again,
I just want you to understand that
it does, you know
the
what?
Guidelines that we have here.
I do not waive any of my rights
for your,
with equitable
for your
remedy by estoppel. And so now what that means is, listen to me, my friend. I'm trying to let you know what that means. The corporation puts you out front there, and you're going to be one of the first individuals to be in trouble, because you're the one that's in the front.
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No. I'm just doing my job.
You're racketeering. You're part of the fraud.
I'm doing my job. I'm not racketeering. I'm doing my
you're
job.
You're part of the fraud.
Yeah.
So you're
anyway, I'm gonna go down to the state of Idaho and see if there is any other thing that possibly might be an exclusion on this that the home office is overlooking. If that's the case, you know, I'll give you a call back to see if we can get it straightened out. But as it sits right now, your tax exempt status wasn't approved.
I'm not tax exempt. I'm tax non-obligatory. It's not my obligation. I'm not obligated to. Exemption would denote that I had to get permission from someone. I don't need permission from anyone.
Well, you know, it's going to have to be that way through our home office.
I don't need you can't deny me even to conduct business there or to buy anything there. You can't do that.
Well, if you do, you're going to have to pay sales tax as it stands right now.
Again, you show, okay, here's what, since you're so confident about that, you send that to me in writing and sign your name to it. I'll give you, you send that to me in writing and sign your name to it.
Send what to you?
You write that in writing that I have to pay taxes. I have to pay sales taxes. You pin your name to it. You sign your name to it. Please do that for me.
Well, no, I don't need to because it's not my.
No, but you're the one saying
the
that you have
Idaho.
A. You're saying you, no. You have a contract with the corporate state of Idaho. I don't. Again, you
this
put
is a matter between you and the state.
No, it's a matter between you. No, I don't have any contracts with the state of Idaho, and I do not waive any of my rights with equitable remedy by estoppel. I'm letting you know right now, if you're so confident in what you say, write that down and sign your name to it.
No, this is a matter you need to take up with the state of Idaho.
I don't have any contracts with the state of Idaho. You, sir, you have a good day.
You need to take care of the state of Idaho, okay?
I in no way waive my rights. And you, sir, have a good day. I see that you wouldn't pin your name to that either.
It's not up to me. It's up to the state of Idaho.
Again, you have a contract with the state of Idaho. I appreciate that. And you have a certified document there showing that I'm not a corporation or operating in a corporate capacity. And you're still going to try to force tax obligations upon me? Man, that's called peonage, man.
It shows what you are as a part of an LLC, a limited liability company. That's all it says.
Bullcrap. It says here, right in front of me, it says, I, Ben Yashura, Secretary of State of the State of Idaho, hereby certify that I am the custodian of the corporations, limited partnership, limited liability companies, limited liability partnerships, and assumed business names records in this state. I further certify that the record of this office failed to show that the cognomen of Chinyera K. Duru, which is a Moorish name, a natural person, and in the corporate capacity, it's not a corporation. And the way you have it printed here, it's not a corporation. And you got it right there in front of you. It's a certified copy. Now, what you're going to end up doing...
It just shows that you're a part of an LLC.
No, it doesn't. It shows that it's not a corporation. It's right there in front of you. This is called a corporate negative search. Anyone can go do one. It's called a corporate negative search, and this is a certified copy. You can play games with someone who doesn't understand this if you want to. Now, again, you're breaking international law. I am a national.
A national. Well, you know, all I know is...
Let me explain this to you. What's your name, my friend? What's your name? Respectfully.
My name's Murray.
Murray, what's your last name?
Well, I don't need to give you that.
No, I'm not being funny. I'm just asking you what you... Because you sound European to me. You don't have any... You're not European?
No, uh-uh.
What are you?
I'm born and raised right here.
I mean, just because you're born here doesn't make you American. So you're Aboriginal and indigenous to this landmass?
Well, I'm born and raised here, if that's what that means. Yeah.
Consanguinity. Where's your family bloodline air from originally?
You know, that has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, it sure does, because you're not... You're trying to put an obligation upon me, and you haven't even proved your status. My status is right there for the record.
The state of Idaho is trying to put the obligation on you.
No, they put that obligation
that's
on you,
right,
and you're
now,
passing it to me.
You need to take it up with some diets. You need to take that up with the state of Idaho.
No, you need to.
And
I don't waive my rights. You have a good day. I'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. I'll take care of it with you, with your corporation.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's go straight into the next segment. Don't forget, if you have questions, now's the time to raise them, because what we're finna deal with now is we're finna deal with this situation that we just heard from Brother Taj Tariq Bey, who already has stated that he's going to put this all over the Internet, and I'm having him right now. Anyway, we're going into the next part. We're going to listen to the next three segments. But if you have any questions or comments, go ahead and raise your hand, because we're going to come directly out of Tahaka's library.
Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from Sweden, Scandinavia. On Thursdays and Sundays, we are here addressing important and interesting subjects with authors, researchers, and filmmakers on a wide variety of subjects. Our website is redicecreations.com, that's R-E-D-I-C-E creations.com. There you will find news, radio, videos, links and resources, our forum, and of course our member section and much more. I'm glad you're here today. We have an important topic that we are going to focus on. We have author Mary Croft with us on the line. She is the author to a book called, really like this title, it's called How I Clobbered Every Bureaucratic Cash Confiscatory Agency Known to Man. And the subtitle is A Spiritual Economics Book on Money and Remembering Who You Are. We're going to talk about money and the concept of natural persons compared to artificial persons, words, law, government tricks, and much more. Mary's website is spiritualeconomicsnow.net. I suggest you head over there and do take a good look around. So it's great to have you with us online, Mary, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, and thank you.
Why don't we do like this? We could begin to talk a little bit about you for listeners who might not be familiar with you or your work. In regards to research and the work that you've been kind of doing, tell us a little bit about your background in this.
Well, you know, my background is probably similar to most of the rest of us who are doing this, and that is that we got beaten up in some way by the alleged authorities. Like somehow, somewhere along the line, something occurred in our lives and we said, hey, wait a minute. This just isn't right. There's something wrong here. We didn't know what it was, but we knew that we were not to be treated like this, whether it's anything from ridiculous traffic violations, whether it's incarceration, whether it's IRS, CRA, ATO, IR, you name it, where I don't know what your tax agency is called over there. Whether it doesn't matter what it is, we all came away from it saying, okay, there's something wrong, and that includes, you know, the banks foreclosing on your house, credit cards, collection agents ringing you and saying, you owe us this much, but you notice they'll never put it in writing. I mean, you just have a feel for it, and you say, okay, I got it. There's something wrong here. Something's going on that shouldn't be going on. And so you start investigating, and you start talking to people, and I, like everybody else, started chasing the best information. And then when I had a hint of it, what I did was I started experimenting, because I contended, and still do, that the cause of every single problem on this planet, and I mean every single problem that is on this planet, is caused from the infliction of commerce by the banks onto the people. The banks have destroyed what might normally have been a decent lifestyle. And I'm not talking the past 100 years. I'm talking hundreds of years. Now, that even stems back as far as the Crown and the Vatican. I don't really want to go back that far because, first of all, most of us weren't there. But for the last 75 years at least, we, by that I mean Western countries, have been operating in a state of bankruptcy. And, in fact, these countries do not even have a government. We've been without a government. We've had de facto governments, but that's not real, not de jure governments. And it's all because we've been operating within a bankruptcy. And that happened in 1933 when in the States and Canada anyway, and probably over there in Europe, you know, they did away with anything with which we could use to pay any debts. So what happened was the government, essentially, the alleged government, said, well, seeing as you can't pay your debts anymore because we've withdrawn all the gold and silver and we're in bankruptcy, but we're not telling you that, we will pay your debts for you. But what happened was, although they designed a remedy, and they just decided not to tell us because it would behoove the banks to control the people of the world by enslaving them. And what's the best way to enslave them is to enslave or steal their labor and their lives. So people started believing that they had to pay for things when in fact we don't. And then what happened is they started laboring, and the fruits of their labors, commonly known as dollars, got stolen from us because they essentially programmed us to believe that we're required to pay for things we need and want. And it simply isn't true. So we start going out trying to get better and better jobs. That's nice. And in order to get more cash, in order to pay them. But the thing is, there's two completely separate accounting systems, and we are not permitted to pay public debt with our labor, which is private. So they've kind of mixed up the two systems of accounting and enslaved us in the process. There's a whole bunch of detail surrounding all that. I mean, you can start firing questions at me from there if you
want. Yes, yes. I mean, there are so many areas, of course, that we can touch upon in regards to background to all of this. And of course, what you mentioned is going to be familiar with too many of our listeners in regards to at least the American, you know, version of this, so to speak, because in many contexts, too many researchers that are looking into these areas, they are primarily talking about what is going on the North American Union. So what I want to ask you like right away, because we have a European audience, we have many people from Australia as well as in, you know, various countries around Europe and South America as well. But in regards to, let's say Europe then, you know, if these kinds of laws that you're talking about, either if we're talking about commerce or other law, that this is something that is applicable in Europe as well as to the United States and North America?
Yes. Nobody in the Western world is operating under any law anymore other than the golden rule, and that is that we're not to infringe upon anybody's person, rights, or property. In other words, we, you know, do unto others how we want to be treated, we want to treat others. So that's the only real law that there is. And everything else that we think of as laws are not laws. They're statutes, codes, rules, regulations, ordinances, bylaws, constitutions, legislations. What did I leave out? They have nothing to do with us. They are simply the policies of the corporations, which appear to be governments, but they're not. And let me use the USG as an example.
Mm-hmm.
The United States government is just a slick corporation, a foreign private belligerent corporation, which happened to be crafty enough to call itself the United States government. But it has nothing to do with what we think of as the country called the United States of America, nor is it a government. It's simply a corporation. And people actually think they're going to march to the polls and elect the president of this corporation. Well, no corporation in the history of commerce has ever had an election for their CEO's presidents. They're all appointed. Think of Sears Corporation. But anyway, getting back to your question, which
right.
is that how does this apply in Europe, for example? Well, the only law under which we all operate is actually not a law. It's a code, and it's called the Uniform Commercial Code.
Yes.
When they did away with any actual laws, which probably happened somewhere in the 30s all over the world. It was 38 in the United States, and I think before that in Canada. But anyway, somewhere around there, they did away with what's called common law, and they instituted the commercial code. And all the commercial code is laws under which we operate in commerce, which happens actually to be maritime commercial law or admiralty commercial law.
Yes.
It all just has to do with banking. There is no other law. There's no criminal code. There's no nothing. Nothing that applies to us. Those policies, laws, statutes, etc., apply only to the people who made them up for the corporation from which they come. So, for example, when a cop, you know, stops you for going through a stop sign, well, show me the law. Well, there can't be a law that says that, unless I agreed to it, of course, and why would anybody do that? I'm not suggesting that people go through stop signs. I'm just using that as an example. That's a statute that doesn't apply to men and women. It applies to corporate entities and the employees of those corporations.
Yes.
So the only laws that really apply are the codes of this Uniform Commercial Code. So we're all operating in commerce, and that means then that even the courts, into which some people actually believe they have to go, they're not courts of law. They're courts of commerce. So when they drag you in saying something like, well, you know, did you murder this guy? Well, it's not about murder. It's about who has stolen whose credit and how much does who owe whom in order to balance the books.
Yes.
Simply bookkeeping. It's accounting. It has nothing to do with anything. It's not about theft. It's not about you name it. It's about accounting and how do we balance the books. And that's what the IRS, et cetera, is all about, is they're there to balance the books. And in fact, they're simply not the enemy that we've always thought they were. That's a statement in itself, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes,
yes. Yeah, right. I know. We all hear about the IRS. In fact, just before you called, I was talking to a friend, and she's extremely concerned about, you know, what's the IRS or the court now, because the issue's in court. What are they going to do? And I said, well, you got to remember, the IRS is only perturbed because you didn't file a tax return in order to get your tax returned to you, and now their books are out of balance and they're blaming you because they don't have the paperwork about how you ran your commercial affairs for that year. Now, if you'll simply let them know how you did that, they'll stop chasing you, and they'll start chasing the ones who actually stole your credit. And in this particular case, the court stole her credit. So all she has to do is name them, and the IRS will go after the judges.
Hmm.
The way we want it. We're planning on putting the courts out of commission, because that system is actually contrary to what's really going on, which is, we are operating in bankruptcy. Every country in the world, when it failed to pay back its debt to the IMF, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, it had to declare bankruptcy, because that's why they collected the gold and silver, because they ran out of everything.
Is this applicable to all nations across the globe, you're saying?
Yes. Possibly not some tribes in the middle of Africa who still use wampum or whatever,
right.
Not disparaging them, they're actually freer than we are.
Sure, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Any country, and we're all working desperately on this to find the correct forms, and just in case your European listeners are wondering about what forms, I can't say this for certain, but we're beginning to think that people over there, and even Australia, New Zealand, and England, they might just have to get EINs, which are employer identification numbers and also international tax identification numbers, known as ITINs, with the IRS, with Social Security, because it seems, I can't say this for certain, but it seems as if the IRS is kind of the head guy as far as collection agents go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody's heard of the IRS. Not everybody's heard of IR or ATO or whatever your, what's your tax agency called there?
They're called Skatteverket.
Good grief.
Yeah.
No, you mean you don't even have an alphabet agency there? I mean, it's called well, anyway. Name.
I guess it's SV for short or something. I don't know if they punch it down to letters like that, but anyway, there you go. Yeah.
That's terrific. Anyway, but you see, I haven't heard of that, but I'm sure you've heard of the IRS.
Yes.
So, it's kind of like they're the big guys, because they truly are the best collection agent on the planet. Well, the truth is, they're supposed to be collecting for us. I know this is really, really hard to imagine. But whenever we have put our labor in the form of cash or credit card payments or debit card payments or money orders or certified checks or however it is, that's all from our labor. When we put that into the public, we are actually obstructing the bankruptcy. Because we're all acting in bankruptcy, in other words, the commercial code is based on and due to bankruptcy, we're actually in violation of public policy, and we're doing it wrong. We're not supposed to be paying anything with our labor. We're supposed to be setting off public debt with our signature, which means when somebody presents you with a bill, which, by the way, they tend not to do anymore because that is the easy way to set off public debt. They're supposed to actually, I mean, you go into a store and you buy a lawnmower. Let's pick on Sears. I always pick on Sears. Do you have Sears over there?
No, we don't, fortunately.
Well, okay, Sears is just kind of your classic store for everything. You know?
I know. Yeah, we have similar ones over here. We have that for sure.
Well, I always pick on Sears because... for no reason other than I thought it was kind of worldwide almost. But anyway, so you go in there. What they're supposed to do when you take your lawnmower to the counter is they're supposed to write you up a bill that says who you are, who the Sears is, and the cost of the thing and what it is, what they get. And what we're supposed to be able to do is simply sign for it, thereby claiming it, and giving them access to what's called a treasury account so that we can let the Treasury know to offset Sears' debt, which Sears created, by the way. We didn't create it by buying the lawnmower. They created it. They wrote it up as a debt. And all we're doing by signing the bill is saying, I'm authorizing the Treasury to balance your accounts for you because I now know you have a debt. So you want it balanced. But for us to pay with cash, our labor, believe it or not, is actually increasing the debt. It's doubling it because the amount's the same. Then they give you a receipt which shows you that you've paid. Well, in fact, this did not set off their debt. It increased the problem because we gave them debt notes. Now, this is a huge, long diversion, which I don't really want to get into, but when we labor, we are putting forth our value, and what we're getting in return is debt notes. In other words, those notes operate in debt. It's kind of like picture the level of seawater. Well, there's nothing. We are putting in something positive, so imagine the sea going up, right? Mm. What they're giving us is something negative, so now we're operating below sea level. So it isn't direct compensation. In fact, we are giving away our labor for nothing. What's that called? Slavery. So this is how they've enslaved us, by pretending to give us something of value that isn't of value. And yet, it's true, we can go and get what we want with that. But we're not supposed to. We're not supposed to be handing over that cash. We're supposed to be setting off public debt with our signature and using cash simply for items between you and me. Like if you want a haircut and I say, hey, I can cut your hair, Hendrick. So you say, come on over. And then you say, well, how can I compensate you? And I can say, well, let's see. You could invite me for supper. That would be a nice compensation. Or... you know what? If you don't want to have me to supper, you can just give me some of those notes that you have, that you get from working. And you say, fine. And I take those and I can do what I want with them.
Mm-hmm.
Go someplace and get something else. So, but not in the public, just the private. In other words, then I could maybe use my friend's computer for the day. And he says, well, how are you going to compensate me? I say, well, I got these notes that Hendrick gave me. So that's how that's supposed to work. We're not supposed to put those notes into the public. We're supposed to be able to walk into any store. They write us up a bill. We set it off by signing our name, which actually instructs the Treasury to set off their debt. So that then, of course, they can go buy whatever it was I just got from them, like the lawnmower. They go back to their supplier, and they get a lawnmower, and they use their account to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've been credited. Now, stop me if it gets too crazy, because I know everything is absolutely the opposite of what we've been thinking.
Yes, yes. So, I mean,
yeah, I know it's a little dingy, but
it's fine. But let's go back a little more and go over it kind of the overview once more here a little bit, because if we think of money right off the bat, obviously it's a means of exchange. It's better in a way, or easier, I should put it, to carry around like, let's say, paper money instead of carrying around, coming with your, tractor or whatever it is that you want to exchange, right? So in that regard, we can think of money as a kind of a symbolic means of exchange. But what you're talking about right here now is that money has been transformed into something else. It no longer represents the true value of what it's supposed to be. Is that correct?
Yes, it does get us what we want. As you say, we don't want to walk around with a tractor in our pocket, so we carry cash. But that's just between you and me in the private. But when we go to work, it's true they're giving us that, but we were never meant to earn our living anyway. And that gets into a whole ethics issue, where what we're supposed to be doing is whatever our talent is. And we all have a talent, whether we've realized it or not. And so we're supposed to be doing that. I mean, there's carpenters out there. There's people who build lovely furniture. There's people who make lovely music. And so what they ought to be doing is doing that for their fellow man. And when their fellow man says, oh, I just love this piece of music that you played for me, or this desk that you built for me, what can I do for you? And then he says, well, you can do this for me. Or if you can't, or you don't want to, or that's not appropriate right now, tell you what, just give me some of those notes and I can take them someplace and get something from somebody else. In other words, we're not even supposed to have these corporations in our lives. They shouldn't even be existing, but the reason they're existing is essentially to confiscate our labor.
Yes.
And they've enslaved us instead of, so we're not working for ourselves anymore and each other. We're working for major corporations, and we're simply cogs in a machine there, and we're not serving anybody by doing it. because most of the people who were, I mean, you look in any city and you can see these skyscrapers. What are people doing in there? They're not doing anything for their fellow man. They're either doing stockbroking or insurance or banking or something that has involved them, rather enslaved them, in the commercial world. There's no good being done from any of these corporations. Now, yes, these corporations do supply us with the goods that we want. And that's where we say, okay, it was my value that funded the manufacture of this because I have a birth certificate, and because you knew that, and by that I mean the alleged governments, what they did was they used the birth certificate as a bond in order to create the credit to create or to manufacture whatever the corporations, in other words, create the corporations and manufacture whatever it is they sell, so that we could simply saunter in there anytime we want and say, I'll take that right there.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's the first two plugs of Mary Elizabeth. I have someone had their hand raised on the line. I'm going to area code 313. Could you tell us who you are, where you're calling from, and what's your question and comment?
Hey, what's up, Brother Taharka? This is brother out of Detroit, Michigan, Richard Black. I spoke with you a couple months ago. My question is, I listened to the recording that you just played concerning a guy in Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
And I recently had a similar conversation here with the state of Michigan concerning a driver's responsibility fee. And I messed around and did a theft for value, blah, 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 paperwork. I gave them a copy of the public law 7310. They actually sent me two letters saying that I was responsible for $400 concerning the fee for not having proof of insurance. I paid the traffic ticket off a couple of years ago, and the lady told me that.
All right, now let me ask you something. You paid the traffic ticket off. All right, now
yeah,
who was the traffic ticket assigned to? Who did it write it to?
To my fishing name.
Fishing name, and you went and gave him some money.
Yep, sure did.
All right, hold on a minute. Let's go to the next caller. Area code 347. 347. Could you tell us who you are, where you're calling from? Area code 347. You got your hand raised. Could you tell us who you are, where you're calling from? Okay, peace, brother. What's your question?
How you doing, Taharka? This is Brother Kyle from New York Republic. That video that you played with that Moore in court, is it on YouTube?
With Moore's in court. I don't understand.
The guy that was challenging the judge.
Huh?
The clip
say it again?
That you played. The clip that
Which
you played
one?
With the Moore challenging the judge about the cell tax.
Oh no. That was Brother Taj Tariq Bey challenging Sam's Wholesale executive in regards to traffic, to taxes. But yes, that is on YouTube. Yes, it is.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Powerful
All right,
show.
Ladies and gentlemen,
hey.
Go ahead, bro.
Powerful show. Thank you.
Okay. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let me put this out there one more time. And if we got it right, Moses, please forgive me. The first brother just called in. Forgive me. What I'm trying to get you to do is just listen very, very closely and just think for a minute. Now, we just ran these past two segments. Let's say that you just been hired on a job. Now, you've been studying Taharka's contract law for, when you put a broadcast up, you've been in there. Okay, so you just got hired. You have agreed to work and exchange physical labor, which is real money, for false money. They're going to give you paper. They're going to give you a paycheck made out of paper. When you go to the bank, they're going to give you some more paper. So now you know if you take that paper and you cold, you put it in five places, strike a match, or whether you be cold, be warm for about 2-3 minutes until the paper burn up. So that means that you ain't never got paid. But you got a backup system because you've already contacted me. You got a hold of my library. You've gotten yourself into your executive estate. You have a power base. Now when you check that there, you are not only going to get paid for the gross amount, but you can now demand that you be paid in real money. Let's say we can't pay you real money. We ain't giving you no gold. We're going to fire you. Oh, my goodness. Thank you very much. Send it to me in writing. I know what to do because what we're going to do is accept the offer, enter a counter offer, and we'll give you the liability to tell you what we're going to do next. You'll never discover whether the water is warm or cold if you don't stick your toe in it.
There would be no how are you going to pay for it because I already paid for it. It was my credit, my future labor and productivity, my value backed by the bond that was floated against the birth certificate that actually covered the cost to make the lawnmower that I just came in to buy or to get, actually.
Mm.
So for them to say you owe us, they say, well, what are you smoking? It's prepaid. I already paid for it. And the example I use in my book is if you have a friend, I get confused on that stuff. Okay, you come to me and you say, Mayor, I'm just about to open a restaurant, but I need the last $10,000 to do it. Can you lend it to me? I say, sure. You say, oh, I'll pay you back with this much interest, and here's when. And I say, fine, away you go. You finish your restaurant. It's absolutely perfect, but you're not doing quite as well as you planned. So, 6 months later, you come to me and you say, uh-oh. We're just squeaking by, but I can't pay you back the $10,000. And what was the interest that I said I'd pay you? You know what? I just don't see this happening. How can I make this up to you?
Mm.
I say, well, I don't. You say, look, tell you what. Anytime you want to come and eat in my restaurant, when the waiter hands you the bill, you simply put your signature on it. I'll know it's you. And then I'll say, oh, thank God, Mary is claiming back some of her credit. Some of what I owe her. And that's exactly what the government ought to be doing through its government-owned corporations. So let's go back to the lawnmower. We go in. When Sears sees my signature on their bill, they should be saying, oh, Mary's claiming back the credit that we took from her in order to make the lawnmower in the first place.
But then you're...
Even exchange.
But then you're talking about that you, as a human being, when you come into or enter into this world, that you have a right, so to speak, to sustain yourself as a human being, right? Because there have to be some kind of foundation, so to speak, on this. Because what you're talking about, I mean, you were obviously talking about like things like slavery before. I mean, I guess we have to as well also kind of go back into history and just look upon how one human being enslaves another, and that's kind of the initiatory step towards this kind of which at this point is an international system of slavery and control, basically, that we're looking at, you know?
Mm-hmm. So is your question, how all of a sudden do I get this credit?
Well, my question is, I guess, how, just to clarify for our listeners, when you say that, when you go into the store and to get that lawnmower, that actually already is prepaid. There is that you actually have paid for it, or you have a right to take it as yours. Isn't that what you're saying?
Yes, I am. And are you asking why?
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's do it again. Only those with birth certificates can do that, because what happened in the 30s was mothers were obliged to register their baby's births, because then what the feds, the government, the alleged government, said was, we now know of this other child that's been born, and it's been registered. It's now a corporation, because the name on the birth certificate certainly isn't the name of any baby.
And we need to go through that later, but yeah, continue your story, yes.
Yeah. So what they've done is, well, they've just simply created, they've registered a name for a corporation, that's all. And so then they send us the birth certificate essentially saying, this is your ticket, this is what you can use to prove that you have unlimited credit from the Treasury. And the reason is because over your lifetime, we intend that you will pay us way more than we will ever pay you. So we're making it unlimited because we need your value in order to pay off the national debt, which of course doesn't really exist, but the concept is that it's been indeed the World Bank lent governments money, then it has to pay it back with interest. The interest, of course, doesn't exist. That's another subject. But so essentially what they said is throughout your life, you'll pay enough in fines and taxes and fees and application, and you name it, that we will collect enough of your dollars in order, essentially, to enslave you. You will be slave laboring. We will get so much more value from your work. And that's why women apparently don't get quite as much credit as men, but that's questionable. But anyway, so they're anticipating getting way more from us. So what harm does it do them to say, you've got unlimited credit? The trick was they didn't tell us that we had unlimited credit. So here we go blithely along slave laboring due to this alleged national debt. We don't owe anybody anything. And they're taking our value where the remedy actually has been written into, well, here it's the Bills of Exchange Act, but it's been, the remedy has been written in, and the remedy is, because we're using your credit, unbeknownst to you, we have to have a remedy, because otherwise it would be unlawful, and we'd be in deep trouble. So we're going to create a remedy, but we're not going to tell you. But the remedy is, everything you could ever need or want is prepaid. Because we used your credit to create the corporation, and we used your credit to manufacture the goods that you'll want, all you really have to do is sign for them. Because we're getting way more from you by slave laboring in a bloody insurance company. And who's that work for? That's for the bank.
So
many of those downtown buildings are strictly make-work projects in order to pay off the national debt to the World Bank.
Yes.
Utter insanity.
So what you're saying here is that on the surface, so to speak, this is what the... If you sit down, study the system, right, and learn all the terms and all the linguistics and all the tricks, as it were, of the system, you discover that this is the reality of it. And if you can understand that, are you saying then that there is a way that you actually can do by law this to function, you know, in your life? Can you go into a store and actually just, you know, make this happen, so to speak, get that lawnmower?
You can, but you got to remember that the employees of the store won't know what in hell you're talking about, right?
Right, right.
So why get into a dissertation? That's not our job to educate. We want to stand there and say, well, look, why don't you know that we have this blah, 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 unlimited credit, and this is mine, and all I have to do is sign it, and you take it to your head office and balance the books on it, blah, blah, blah. No, we're not going to bother with that. So what we're going to do is go along with them and say, here, what do you want? You want my cash? Okay, here. Now, what we do is we, at the same time, this is, now I'm going to use U.S. terms only because that's sort of the biggest, sort of, and I know the form names.
Yes.
But so what we do is we hand them a copy of what's called a 1099 OID, and you don't need to know that other than what it does is it states who is issuing the credit. It's essentially stating that I am the source of the credit, not Sears.
Mm-hmm.
So, because if we just hand them our cash and we don't say who it is, they'll say that they're the source of the credit, and then they call it, it gets a little technical here, but they call it abandoned funds, and then the IRS won't tax them. They'll come back and tax us in order to balance its books. But that's a bit complicated. So here's the drift. So we give them certain forms. One of them is this OID, and another one is what's it called? 1099, or pardon me, a 1040V, which is a voucher. And by the definition of voucher is a payment. And so all that means, or actually it's an authorization of payment. So then you send that to the Treasury, and you give these people a copy so that they know what you're up to. You get their tax identification number, and the Treasury sets off their debt for them. And then, of course, they've got, not only do they have it set off by the Treasury, they've still got our cash, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they say, oh, now we got this cash. Well, what the IRS will do is simply go back to the company and say, okay, your debt's been set off to you, and we now know that you have somebody's cash that you're not supposed to have, so give it back, and we'll get it back for the one who bought the goods. So essentially, the purpose of the IRS is actually to track down what we have put into the public and get it back for us. But we have to be very careful to give them the correct forms in order to do that. So it really is a case of, going into the store and setting off the debt. But because nobody knows that, because they've been so programmed in school that they have to pay for everything, they presume that we have to pay for everything.
Well,
and try walking out of a store without paying for something.
Yeah, there you go.
So if you give them whatever it is they want, then you can just go back and say, look, I'll give you this, but I'll get it back from you later. Not to worry. This is not my job to educate you on commerce.
Right, right. But so what we kind of get back to here then is the fact that it doesn't feel like the system has been set up in order to operate in this case, at least not for the the guy or gal walking down the street, so to speak. This is the system feels like it is actually designed in order to deceive us, and this gets us into the other aspect that you were talking about, that this has to do with indoctrination and that everyone just goes along what their parents taught them or whatnot. But I mean, even if we were to come up to a point where we discover this and we learn how the system works, then it feels like they would actually just change the system into something else in order to sustain the control over us, if you know where I'm going with this, so to speak. Do you follow me?
I do. Now, and this is the problem we've been having for so long, up until recently, and that is...
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we ran three plugs of this lady, and she just gave you the basic modus operandi of what's happening inside the United States in regards to debt notes and the fiction. We've already did our previous broadcast showing you that the entire United States operates on a continuous series of contracts under contract law. It doesn't matter what color you are, what gender you are, you are either a debtor or a creditor. Now, we only ran three segments of Elizabeth here, but what we have is her entirety, six plugs, including her entire book. And with this is enough artillery to get the Moors to think and begin to transform your current situation and start doing things differently. All you have to do is listen to the broadcast over and over and over again until you get it right. That's all. I don't think it can get no simpler than that. Because when you do that, what happens is it is picked up by the brain and stored in the memory, and you are able to regurgitate what you know. You cannot regurgitate anything that you don't know. If you get out in the streets and call somebody H or B, that's because you've been hearing it over and over and over. It's recorded by the brain, and then you regurgitate it. But when you regurgitate something worthwhile that's going to make some necessary changes in your life, then you have some real power. Okay? Now, I was supposed to go into this segment in regards to gun laws, but we're going to deal with something else right now. I'm going to go into the last segment, and this ties directly into what we've been talking about, because what we're dealing with now is the foundation of some knowledge and things, and I want the Moors to understand some things. And the thing is, just like Mary said at the beginning, of knowing who you are. Okay, so let's get into this part right here for a minute.
There is a famous book out there called The Serious Mystery by Robert Temple. He's been on the program before, that talks about the Dogon tribe acquiring incredible knowledge from extraterrestrials. Now we'll talk with Laird Scranton about that, his work, The Science of the Dogon. Let's see if they mix. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. This hour we'll talk more about cosmology with Laird Scranton. Laird, tell me about what you first learned about the Dogon tribe, and who are they?
Okay, the Dogon are a priestly, modern-day African tribe. They're outwardly primitive, and they are from Mali, which is a country in the northwest bulge of Africa. And in my opinion, the Dogon tribe, for anybody who is interested in ancient symbols or ancient religion and what it all means, the Dogon are a great untapped resource.
Mm-hmm.
And my my first exposure to the Dogon came, as you said, through Robert Temple's book, The Serious Mystery. And I began following some of his sources when I began to research about the Dogon. The thing that brought the Dogon to the attention of the public was the fact that they seemed to know some things about astronomy that they shouldn't know without having powerful telescopes. They knew that the Sirius star system involved two stars, not one, and that one of them was a very tiny dwarf star, and they knew that the orbital period of the two stars for each other, among other things. And so I began to pursue that, and I discovered that that's just really the tip of the iceberg. You might remember that Carl Sagan proposed that that the Dogon knowledge about these stars came from some modern visitor to the tribe.
Right.
But when you get down into the Dogon system, you realize that this information about Sirius is part of a much larger system of knowledge. And all the words used to describe that system are really ancient Egyptian words. And so from my perspective, I can't imagine a modern visitor who could have come to the Dogon and told them these things who would have couched them in ancient Egyptian words.
Now, explain that a little bit more for me.
Okay. The words that define the system that that scientific knowledge is part of are all ancient Egyptian words. And so if you imagine some modern-day scientist coming to visit with the Dogon and telling them things they didn't know, how possibly could that person have been capable of giving that information to the Dogon using ancient Egyptian
words? Okay. All right. I follow you there. There's no way they could.
Right. And so that's the first indication that we're talking about a system that really is ancient.
Now, how did this first start? How did we first learn about the Dogon tribe and the Sirius mystery, even before Temple wrote the book?
Okay, there are two French anthropologists, a man by the name of Marcel Griol, who was the foremost anthropologist of his day, and his student, whose name was Germain Dieterlen. And they spent the better part of 30 years, starting in 1930, living among the Dogon and researching them and filming them and interviewing them and studying every aspect of their religion and documenting it. And they produced a work called The Pale Fox, which is the definitive statement about what the Dogon religion is and what it means. And that's one of my primary resources. Now, I have an advantage over Temple in that at the time Temple wrote that anthropological study hadn't been translated from French into English, and he only had a partial translation of small pieces of it, whereas I was able to work from the entire translated text. But having this text is a lot like having the teacher's copy of the book. You remember back in grade school?
Sure.
You know, you had your copy of the book, but the teacher's copy had all the answers to the questions.
Yeah, that's the book we wanted.
That's right. Well, the Dogon priests are living priests. You know, this is like having an Egyptian priest that you could sit down and talk to and ask questions of. And having that, anytime you have a question about what does this symbol mean or what does this term mean, you can go to this anthropological study and you can go to a dictionary of the Dogon language and a couple of other texts that are related to those, and you can come up with what look an awful lot like answers to questions that have seemed pretty formidable without them.
What can you tell us about the Sirius star system? Let's put that in perspective.
Okay, the Sirius star system is important in a lot of ancient cultures. The Dogon, part of the problem with the Dogon is they don't have a native written language, and so we don't have any historical records to be able to prove that they were once closely associated with the Egyptians. But pretty much everything the Dogon do, you can count on the fact that the ancient Egyptians did too. The Dogon are like a crossroads for several ancient traditions. They have rituals that are a lot like ancient Judaism, and they have civic practices that are like ancient Egypt, and they have a cosmology that's like ancient Buddhism. And so here you have in one package information that binds all of these traditions together, and Sirius is sort of at the heart of that. The Dogon have a festival called the Sigi Festival. Now, the word Sigi is really an Egyptian word, Sakai, that means to celebrate a festival. So you find this term turning up in ancient cultures around the world, even in the names of different ancient tribes, this concept of celebrating a deity or celebrating a cosmological concept. And so Sirius is central to all this stuff. Now, Robert Temple said that the reason it was central is because the teachers of the Dogon, the ones who brought them this ancient knowledge, were from Sirius. I can't disprove that. That might be true. That might not be true. There's certain indications that it could be. In the Egyptian hieroglyphic language, the word for Sirius is the name same pronounced the same as the word for teacher.
Okay, there's no doubt, though, that whether they got it from extraterrestrials or whatever, they did not have modern telescopes available to see a second star system. Is that correct?
That's right. But if you go far enough back in any of these ancient traditions, what you bump up against is a belief on the part of the culture that they received civilizing instruction from somebody who knew more about it than they did.
Okay. Now, this system that's there now, are we saying that extraterrestrials live in that star system region and they came here and possibly told this tribe, this is where we're from?
That's one of the possibilities, yes. However, there are also astronomical reasons why Sirius might be important without it necessarily being true that someone came from there.
Did they ever describe the Dogon tribe what these beings might have been?
Yes, they do. Robert Temple provides descriptions from the Dogon that he believes are descriptions of the aliens. If you boil it down to the essence, the Dogon priests say that these were spiritual beings and that they were concerned about what the long-term effect would be of long-term contact between themselves and material beings like us. And so their answer to that problem was they took 8 Dogon tribes people and removed them from the rest of the tribe and instructed them in this civilizing system and then sent them back to teach everybody else. And that sort of limited any detrimental effects that might happen from them being around us.
How long were these visitors here? Do we know?
No, that's hard to say, but what we can say is you can see evidence of the same all around the world, in culture after culture. And part of what I do in my books is based on this Buddhist and Egyptian and African pattern of cosmology, I sort of extrapolate what the original plan of the civilizing plan must have looked like, and I use it to predict what I'm going to find when I go study a culture I know nothing about. I picked a little priestly tribe up in Tibet and China called the Naki and first laid out the prediction of what their cosmology was going to look like and then went and showed that all of the key elements existed just like they were supposed to.
Laird, are the Dogon, are they still there?
Yes, the Dogon are still there. And one of the things that happened in ancient times is that periodically they would send a group of priests out to deliberately locate themselves someplace inhospitable, removed from everybody else, sort of as a way of preserving the tradition, kind of like making a backup copy of the tradition at a particular point in time. And so the Dogon live out in the middle of the desert in Mali, an 8-hour drive from anything you might want to visit, and in a really inhospitable climate along the cliffs of an escarpment where it's very difficult to even eke out a living. And this is where they chose to make their life.
Are they still talking about this incredible story?
Yes, although that's hard to explain. Okay, the French anthropologist wrote their study, and then Robert Temple wrote his book, and suddenly the Dogon were controversial, and the traditional scientists felt like, people like Carl Sagan felt like that they needed to refute what Temple had to say. And so in the 1980s, a Belgian anthropologist named Walter van Beek revisited the Dogon and restudied the things that Griol had studied. He spent several years restudying what Griol had studied for 30 years. And he concluded that the Dogon had no cosmological system, that the obliging Dogon priests had simply made up a system that wasn't real in order to satisfy the questions that the French anthropologist kept asking them.
Tell me about this similarity with the hieroglyphs of Egypt in the Dogon tribe and the significance of that.
Okay. Before we leave Van Beek, the thing that says that Van Beek can't be right is the fact that the Dogon system of cosmology, I discovered, is a point-for-point match for a Buddhist cosmology that's associated with the Buddhist stupa. And so my perspective on that is that the Dogon priests couldn't possibly have casually invented a system that is Buddhism.
No, I would agree with that. Okay, now what about their Egyptian tie-in?
Okay, now these terms that are so important to the cosmology are all Egyptian terms. Now, the problem with trying to compare words between cultures is that there are so few phonetic values that you can't rule out the possibility of coincidence. If you have a word with a meaning and you go to another culture and they have the same pronunciation associated with the same meaning, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's a connection between the words. But whoever put together this civilizing plan for the Dogon did me a favor. And what they did was they associated at least two distinct meanings with every word, and those meanings are logically disconnected. For example, the name of the god Amma, which is the equivalent of Amen in Egypt, means to be hidden, but it also means to grasp or hold firm or to establish. So now, if you know the first meaning, you can't reasonably guess the second meaning. And so now when you take this word and this pronunciation with its two meanings, and you go to another culture and you find the same pronunciation with those same two disconnected meanings, you've got a lock on the word and you know there has to be a relationship.
You have said that you believe that there was a deliberate plan to civilize humanity through their symbols and myths. Tell me about that.
Okay. The upshot of what I understand the plan to have been, the idea was that they were going to raise us up from the level of hunter-gatherers to farmers, essentially. And in order to do that, they had to give us the tools we needed, the tools that are related to agriculture that we needed. We needed good calendars and an understanding of how time works, because you can't plant and reap agricultural products if you don't know the timing of when to do it. They gave us skills of metallurgy to be able to create the implements used to plow a field and so forth. And along with it, there's a list of civilizing skills that the French anthropologists lay out that were instructed. And you find these same skills in China, and you find them in Tibet, and you find them in New Zealand, and you find them all over the world. The culture's listing a tradition of ancient teachers who taught these same skills.
These ancient teachers, how did they learn this?
But they already knew. I mean, they were already civilized. And so the idea was, I mean, it looks to me as if a group was delegated to come here and deliberately teach us in all the different regions. Now, you know about Carl Jung's theory of archetypes. Carl Jung explains the similarities in myth and symbol in all these different cultures by basically claiming that we're wired to think of concepts of creation this way, and that there's a collective unconscious by which this information is transmitted. I take a different approach. I say that the reason that we have all these similarities is because we all have the same teacher. If you imagine that you and I had the same math teacher, you know, years apart from each other in high school, we might have come out of it with all the same stories and all the same examples.
That's right. Exactly. What do you think happened with the Dogon? How do you think they got their information?
Okay. The evidence to me says that around just before the first dynasty in Egypt, the Dogon were Egyptian. And they got their information the same way the Egyptians got it. They were part of that instruction. And this priestly tribe was sent out to make a sort of backup copy of their tradition at that point, just before written language was introduced. And in Egypt, there's a tradition that says that the Egyptian hieroglyphic language was a gift from the gods.
Okay.
So now the Dogon have all of these early references and all the early civic traditions of ancient Egypt, but they don't have the written language. But what's interesting is that the symbols and shapes and concepts that are developed through this cosmology, many of them are Egyptian glyph shapes. so I, it occurred to me, if I looked at an Egyptian word that included these shapes, what would happen if I substituted the concept the Dogon defined for the shape in the Egyptian word? It turns out that all of these words are symbolic sentences, and the meaning of a sentence is the definition of the word. The best example I can give you of that is an Egyptian word for week that is written with two glyphs. It's written with the sun glyph, which is a circle with a dot that represents the concept of a day, and the second glyph is the number 10. And so I looked at that word, and I said, symbolically, this word is telling me that a week is 10 days long. So
okay,
I did some research, and sure enough, the Egyptians had a 10-day week.
All right, well, let's assume you're right, that the Dogon tribe were Egyptians. How does that still explain the knowledge of the dual star system of Sirius when I'm not sure even the Egyptians knew?
Well, because they didn't have to. If we're postulating that there were knowledgeable teachers here, whatever the knowledgeable teachers knew, it's possible for the Dogon to know.
Are you saying those knowledgeable teachers, though, might have been extraterrestrial?
Extraterrestrial or extra-dimensional, someone smarter than us is the best I can say.
Okay.
Someone more educated than us.
I would accept that. I think that's a pretty good theory. And so you somewhat echo Robert Temple.
Right. If you remember the board game Clue, you know.
One of my favorite games.
A player in Clue proposes a theory that involves three parts, and then each player has to say whether they can disprove it or not. Well, where I am with Temple is that he has made his statement in his book, and I don't feel that I'm in a position to dispute any of the things he says. I can't flatly refute anything about his theory.
Good old Clue. The person, the weapon, and the room.
That's right.
Remember that?
That's right. But Temple was very helpful to me in terms of providing me with a trail of references to pursue in my studies.
All right. That's good. People even play board games anymore, Laird?
I don't know. Not since iPhones, I don't know.
Everything's video these days. They don't
That's
do
right.
That, that would be an interesting show all by itself. What's happened to board games and people?
That would be very interesting.
They had. Well, this is good work, and this is exciting that these teachers. I'm going to make the assumption that the Dogon or the Egyptians at the time, they were visited by extraterrestrials. Now, here's an interesting theory. Let's assume they were Egyptian, and they were visited by ETs as Egyptians before they even moved off to parts of Africa there, beyond
right.
Egypt. That might also let you think this is how they built the pyramids, extraterrestrial help. Can you take it that far?
Yes, you could. And in Egypt, one of the things that confuses all the people who are studying Egypt is, why is it that everything is perfect at first and degrades from that point, as if someone forgot how to do the thing? The first pyramids are the perfect ones, and the ones after that are less perfect.
Exactly. And
what I compare that to is, if you ever took a shop class in middle school, like a wood shop class, you know that the first thing the teacher does when he wants you to build a pair of bookends or a bookshelf is he presents you with a perfect copy of that bookshelf that he made.
Good
and
point.
Then from there, the students make their bookshelves, and you find that the ones the students make are noticeably less perfect than the one the teacher presented.
We're going to talk more. Let's talk about Egypt. I want to get your take on the pyramids, Laird, when we come back. We're talking about Laird's two books, really. He's got more out there than two, but we're talking about the Velikovsky heresies. That's what we did last hour. And this hour, the science of the Dogon. Fascinating. By the way, we talk about board games. Stratego, another one of my favorites. I don't even know if they make that anymore. Anyway, we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, next hour we'll take your phone calls with Laird Scranton as we talk about, of course, Velikovsky and also the Dogon tribe and much more. And we'll come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Laird, let's talk a little bit about Egypt. You know John Anthony West, right?
Yes, John Anthony West has been a very, very good friend to me. He's an amazing guy. He took the manuscript, actually the self-published version of my first book, down to New York to a publishing fair and personally shopped publishers for it.
Oh, that's good. That's super. I mean, he's been a great Egyptologist over the years, hasn't he?
Yes, he has been. He's really the man to go to about pretty much anything. he's coming up on his 80th birthday, the 9th of July, and he's just an amazing guy. He's got more vitality than almost anybody I know.
What did he think of Zahi Hawass and that whole situation? Did he ever talk to you about it?
Yeah, I know that John has a lot of respect for Zahi, and he sympathized with the situation. John was in Egypt with a tour group at the time all the upheaval happened in Egypt. And for a while, friends of John were concerned, including myself, were concerned about his safety and the safety of the group. I think they were holed up in a hotel for a while, and then I finally was put to rest. My worries were put to rest by a photograph he sent me of himself on a private cruise ship sailing up the Nile drinking alcoholic beverages.
Well, he was lucky there. What do you think came first, Laird, the Sphinx or the Great Pyramids?
Oh, the Sphinx. I think the Sphinx is distinctly older than the pyramid, although it's hard to tell. I mean, you can't really carbon date stone, so
right.
Theoretically the pyramid could be a lot more ancient than anybody thinks.
Could be 50,000 years old. Could be more.
It could. I mean, it's hard to tell. There's no way of really determining it.
So as you put all this together, what your work on Velikovsky, your work on the Dogon tribe, you know, you've got some other works out there about myths and symbols. What does this tell you? There's a common denominator here, isn't there?
Yes, actually there is. There are some things they were trying to get at here. This whole civilizing plan is it's tagged to a creation tradition, and the creation tradition is based on science. And what I noticed was the Dogon priests say that that their religion describes how their tribal god created matter. And I could see that they had the definition of an atom, right? And I could see that they had the definition of neutrons, protons, and electrons, right? And that made me wonder if maybe the descending levels of the creation of matter could also be right. And so I started educating myself, reading, you know, Stephen Hawking and Brian Greene, and trying to come to an understanding of how science thinks matter is created. And in this first book, The Science of the Dogon, one of the things I do is I lay side by side the Dogon description of the stage of matter with a description from Hawking or Greene, and the Dogon drawing that goes with that side by side with a diagram from Hawking or Greene, and show that the systems are the same, that the Dogon have it absolutely right. And to some extent, the Dogon actually go farther than science does. Science doesn't try to address the process, the problem of how is it that matter behaves like a wave to begin with, and then after it's perceived, it behaves like a particle. But the Dogon do.
Are there other societies on this planet that you think possess some ancient knowledge as well?
Every single last one of them, all of the major ancient traditions, are tied to the same system. And part of what I do in my third book, which is called The Cosmological Origins of Myth and Symbol, is I try to lay out a set of what I consider to be the essential elements of this tradition, the signature elements of this tradition. And by that I mean that if you find this to be true in a culture, then that's a very good indication that they had the same cosmology. And it's all over the planet. And there are certain telling aspects that you can look at that say, absolutely. It even comes down to things like there were originally naming conventions for these tribes. The tribes were originally named for the deity they celebrated. For example, in Judaism, the ancient name for the tribe is Yahuda, which means praises Yah.
Okay. Do you find, too, that all these ancient civilizations all seem to say something? Depends on interpretation of an extraterrestrial visitation?
No, and actually, a large part of what I've tried to do in my books is to protect myself against wishful interpretation. And the way that I do that, one way that I do that is that any interpretation that I offer up has got to be based on an explicit statement on the part of the culture that I'm studying. In other words, we start out with some text or some authoritative person in the tradition flatly saying this is true.
That's fascinating all by itself, isn't it?
When you get back down to the bottom of the tradition, it always comes back to knowledgeable ancient teachers that the culture either thought of as gods or as revered ancestors, or sometimes they're even patriarchs of families or whatever.
Next week, my investigative reporter is going to be talking with us about Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, and she spent some time out there.
It's the same tradition.
Yeah, I was going to say, what are your takes on that? This is very, very old, isn't it?
Yes, it is very old. Now, okay, the farther back in time you go, the more these words of cosmology are the same from culture to culture.
Okay,
now in Turkey, the word tepe has about 25, in the Turkish language, it has about 25 different meanings. Well, I've been able to show that at least 15 of those meanings also exist under the same pronunciation in ancient Egypt. Now, the Egyptians had a tradition of the first time, which is Zeptepi. So I say to myself, based on the words and based on the tradition in Egypt, it looks like these two traditions might be connected. When John Anthony West and Robert Schock were going to Göbekli Tepe to check things out there, I started researching the various images that are carved into the stones there. And I noticed that some of the animals that are represented are important in the cosmological tradition, and some of them aren't. And so I started exploring the names of those animals in the Egyptian hieroglyphic language, the ones that are not important to the tradition. And what I discovered was that the names of each of those animals is actually pronounced like one of the key terms of the cosmology.
Larry,
so in other words, this might have been a sort of proto-writing where an initiate would walk up to this megalith and see the picture of the animal and say the name of the animal, and they were actually saying a cosmological term.
Right. How would you categorize the Bible in terms of ancient text?
It's 3,000 years too late.
What do you mean by that?
Okay, that by the time you get to the Bible, there are signs that there's sort of a watered-down version of what the Dogon have from 3,000 B.C., yes, you can draw parallels between the two and see how one thing might come out of the other, but the Bible is the net result of, for me, is the net result of the process of the dilution of the system over 3,000 years.
Were there any similarities in the book of Genesis that from these other cultures that you studied?
Yes, many of the key concepts are still there, but again, in a watered-down form and in a way that you can't get back to the science from it. In the Dogon tradition, you can get directly to the science. You can lay it side by side with the science and see that it's the same thing. And so you have creation coming from waves in the Dogon tradition, and you also have that Genesis, that the first thing that happens is the word of God over the waters.
Do they all talk, though, of this creation? Done by this intelligent design?
Not in so many words. The cultures that seem to have done the best job of preserving the details are the ones that never developed writing. Because the system was originally cast in mnemonics. The stupa, which is an aligned ritual shrine all across India and Asia, is a grand mnemonic. If an initiate can remember how to build a stupa, they're recreating all the key shapes that are important to the cosmology. And so you could actually recreate a lot of the important elements of the tradition simply by remembering how to build it.
All right, Larry, give me an overall view, though, a perspective on this planet, the history of the planet. You've looked at different facets of it. What have you concluded about all of this?
Okay, if someone came up to me and said, okay, time's up. You don't have any more time to research this. You need to say now what you think. It looks to me that in ancient times, somebody delegated a group of teachers to come here and help us lift us up from the level of hunter-gatherers to farmers, and that group was specifically precluded from giving us real science, but that the group of teachers, as they were preparing for the plan they were going to teach us, they realized, like any good parent does, you know, if you're going to teach your child about where babies come from and they're 2 years old, you're not going to give them all the morbid details, but you're going to make up a story that's based on what really happens. You're going to say that a part of the father comes together with a part of the mother and creates the baby. You're not going to say that the stork brings the baby.
Why do you think they would only give us a portion of this knowledge and not go the full distance?
Well, actually, from what I see, the ones who implemented the plan did go the full distance, and they put themselves intensely on the line to provide us with the best information. And that at a later point, someone we'll call bigger than...
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes our segment. I'm sorry I was unable to give you all of the information that we have here this evening for you, but keep in mind that it will be put into Hawkins Library in its entirety. Volumes 1, 2, 3, and 4 will be there on this particular broadcast that we finished listening to. And I want you to keep in mind that the overall factor of why I put this information there is I want you to understand that all knowledge comes from you. Maritime Amateur Law, all of what they're calling law and how they're dealing inside the United States, all of it derived from your teaching and from your ancestors that were given to you. Okay? So what I'm going to need you to do is to get the full scoop on this thing and to get all the power is contact me, Tahaka Amana El Bay, at area code 904-303-9061. And we get you in that library so that you will have some power and you'll be able to do what you have to do. And you have access to all the information. And you can empower your family. Until next week, ladies and gentlemen, I'll have to close down. And the next broadcast is going to be involving manhood. The more is the manhood. That's what we're coming up with next. And I'll do that in the next couple of days. But right now I'm going to have to shut this thing down. And until next time.
All right. Mm-hmm.